Hello, this is Pastor Chip Anderson, Christ Presbyterian Church in the Hill, and this is the message that will be the sermon on June 14th during our transitioning worship service at 158 Davenport Avenue. We will be meeting in the back patio, what I call the well. And hopefully we will see as many, maybe even more than we did last week. This isn't a proof text to thump on your cultural enemy. Deconstructing starts at church. I had brought my three youngest to listen to one of my favorite nonfiction authors at a nearby library. Ages about 11 to 7. No one expected our youngest to sit still, but William Martin had them spellbound with stories, even the youngest. Back in the minivan heading home, I did what I always do after events I took my kids to. I always ask the question, what are two things you learned? I usually appoint the first to go by announcing the name of the child. Like, what are the two things you learned? Michael, go. But I barely got the question out. What are the two things you learned from William Martin tonight? When they all shouted in unison, blow something up. Well, before you get too worried, William Martin said when he was at a loss for the right words or a plot twist or even a plot development, he applies what he calls the principle, when you don't know what comes next, blow something up. I think this is exactly what is happening here with Paul's continued introduction. Of course, he knows what's going to happen, but it is one of those blow something up moments. He has written a plot twist that would have been equivalent in his day to blowing something up. When he writes, would have startled, have had startled reactions because it hit at the most basic cultural and socially acceptable practice of gaining honor and dehumanizing those they felt less than human. I had planned a paper a while back for my annual trek to the Evangelical Theological Society, their annual meeting on Romans 1, 18 through 32, but I put it on hold for lots of reasons. But here's the title, nonetheless. I like the title, and I want you to hear the title. It helps with where I'm going with the text this morning, Romans 1, 24 through 32. Here's the title of the paper. The Church's Voice Against Child Sex Trafficking and Other Forms of Inhumanity. A Far Better Reading of God's Wrath Against All Ungodliness and Unrighteousness. Of course, that is built on the Romans 1, 18 through 32. From my introduction, I think that I want to use it here. We know that some read the Bible, at one time in the past to justify slavery. Ranked non-white human beings as less than human, and defended the subjugation of women to men and wives to husbands, nor addressed the plight of children in general and abused children specifically. That's how they read their Bible in many places. They were wrong. We were wrong. Now the debate rages today regarding human sexuality and gender and same-gender attraction and same-gender marriage, all using the Bible to clarify, justify, and defend a preferred position, whether for or against. There is a selectiveness on all sides, and as well pitting God is love texts against, and in some arguments to override, quote, judgment texts like God's wrath is revealed texts. Although certainly important issues, same gender attraction and same gender marriage, I believe those are important, but I am of the opinion that many New Testament passages used to focus attention on the issue of same gender marriage are a distraction to other, actually more important issues for the church. Romans 1, 18 through 32 is one such text in the New Testament. When Paul writes that he is not ashamed of the gospel in Romans 1, 16, it is juxtaposed to the worst we can do to each other, 1, 24 through 32. The gospel that reveals the righteousness of God is contrasted to the inhumanity of what humans can do to other humans. My paper was to be a brief examination of Romans 1 that would suggest that the house churches in Rome, chapter 16, actually gives the reader, us, a venue to consider, which also offers a different read to the Roman 1:18 following description of humankind's fall. I will suggest Paul is directing his severe language to the house churches for the specific reason of their contrast to the Roman temple visits, which was mirrored, if you will, during the after supper activities at typical Roman symposia. The gathering of honored guests, the host, and social peers after a banquet-styled evening supper. The very venue adapted by the house churches and the early church that was growing in the Gentile world. To be honest, this is a difficult passage to preach on. It is almost a X-rated passage, really, that has to be given in PG form in a sermon. Of course, for some, it is plain and simple. God is against homosexuality. But some of that preaching and application actually dredges up application and attitudes that are 180 degrees from Paul's intention here. Why do I think there is an underlying cultural and social venue here in Paul's words in Romans 1, 18 through 32, which includes our text this morning, verses 24 through 32? The background that hooks the reader is the venue of the after-banquet supper meeting called the Symposium. Now, this also includes the temple worshiping of the typical upper-class Roman citizen, especially the Greeks Paul already has spoken of. Why do I include the temple worship? Because the supper itself and the after-supper symposium was a mirror of an outworking of temple worship. Let me give you my list of reasons. I believe this is in Paul's mind and the background for listening to what Paul writes here in Romans chapter 1. Each of these could be a message or a teaching in and of themselves, but we're going to just have to leave them there. The first underlying thing is Rome's cultural pursuit of honor, the cultural and social system of honor, which allows for human tiered hierarchy. Paul has already addressed this in Romans chapter 1 already, and he will address this again in Romans chapter 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. He will talk about the right and wrong use of honor and some of the implications of the Adam Christ, in Romans chapter 5. The second thing is the food, the table, issues and the symposium issues in chapters 14 through 15. Since we know the church adopted the venue, there is food issues, which means there are table issues, symposium issues. The third thing is idolatry is rooted in Paul's description of our sinful condition, mentioned in the first chapter, verses 18 through 23 already, and the place of the temple idolatry in the everyday life of a Roman. The fourth thing, and this is the obvious class divisions and the dehumanizing of the underclass already alluded to in chapter 1, where Paul lists the elite Greeks and the barbarians and the underclass and the non-educated versus the educated and the Jew. The fifth and last is the intentional list of naming house churches in Rome in chapter 16. All five of these more than suggest Paul has the Supper Symposium background in mind, and it is why the Christian Supper Symposium, which we call the Gathered Church, is such an important application in chapters 12 through 15, underlying mutual welcoming among the house churches. One last thing, one of addressing the elephant in this passage, and one of caution. Many leverage this passage to speak out against homosexuality, let's face it, and some with hatred and bigotry and malice. Many see in this passage Paul's longest set of words on the topic of homosexuality. And it is certainly, but perhaps not for the reasons so many attach to it. But we should recognize in the ancient Near East, here in Romans, the men are not homosexual men, but heterosexual men committing sexual acts toward passive men and women from the underclass for pleasure and honor gaining. I think, and I believe wholeheartedly, that this passage, this New Testament passage, is Paul's very direct indictment and most savage indictment of polytheism and its honor system, a condemnation on its dehumanizing of people, directed at the heart of both their worship and their social life. So we got the first thing. Number one, what we do with our bodies flows from where we seek to gain honor. What we do with our bodies flows from where we seek to gain honor. Verse 24, therefore God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of the bodies, of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth of God about God for a lie, and worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. Verses 24, 25. The therefore here connects to what just came before. Specifically, they claim to be wise, but became fools. That is, humans have exchanged the glory of God for the image of mortal human beings and the images of animals. This is what we have lost. We have lost our created purpose. Therefore, God gave them up so that they would live with their impure hearts that leads to dishonoring, there's the honor-shame concept again, their bodies, why they were created. Have you ever seen a movie that has taken what took place over a lifetime or over decades or over months, condensed down into less than 2 hours? Things are missing. Events are left out. Events and people are combined. Even the invention of things to help with the plot. Some things are invented. Of course, we have sometimes, right? We have, right? But we don't like it, but we accept it because the writers, the producers, and the director only have 2 hours to tell the whole story. Well, in some way, Paul has done the same thing here. Paul has the creation story in mind, as well as the whole sweep of history and his present time in history's flow, the Roman Empire. all condensed in a few verses, really, 1:18 through 32. We need to recognize this. This is God's story of humankind from Adam till Paul's day. So this text is both a general indictment against mankind and a description of the world in which Paul now lives. If anything, God handing over man to man basically is that God has allowed the course of history wherein man lives and has lived apart from God continue to exchange God's glory for the image of man and the image of animals. It's the natural process of history. God ceased to hold the boat as it was dragged by the current of the river. But there is one more thing we need to consider. The swipe of history and God's indictment of humankind is also done in light of the gospel. And we will see more of this as we move into the rest of the book of Romans. But for now, you cannot even have this look of humankind without the gospel, because it is the gospel that defines the condition of man apart from the gospel. The gospel includes a social element. We've got to see Paul has already brought that up. That makes it good news. That means exchanging the glory of God for the image of created things is a lie that leads to improper social behavior, harmful and degrading to others. More on that in a moment. I also find it funny that when this passage is preached or taught, we like to say they exchanged. God handed them over. They believe a lie. Which the text is true, it does say they. But really, we need to own this and say we exchanged, because that's the point. God handed us over, that's the point. We believed a lie, that's the point. God handed us over because we exchanged the truth of God for a lie, all because we did not honor God and give him thanks as God. So what is this lie? The lie is thinking it's okay to worship and serve the creator, the creature, rather than the creator. The lie is thinking there is no eternal consequences before God and thinking there are no social implications. Bad inhuman implications towards others. It is no wonder later when the fix is in, the social remedy, the illusion, the illustration of the good news is discussed by Paul pointing to our bodies. When he turns to the church gathering, he says in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 through 5, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to what? Present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. This is the reversal of Romans chapter 1, 24 through 32, which is your spiritual worship, which is your service of worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. This is the problem with Romans chapter 1. People have come under a improper mind, that by testing you may discern what the will of God is and what is good and acceptable and purpose perfect. For by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. A reversal of the pagan virtue list that's coming soon, but to think the mind with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned. Now listen, now Paul is directing this completely toward the gathered church. As in one body, we have many members, and the members do not all have the same function. So we, though many, are one body in Christ and individually members of one another. Our one body left unredeemed moves us toward dishonoring our bodies among each other. And when we dishonor our bodies, we affect how we dishonor others. Whereas those in Christ present their bodies for proper worship and service to the one body of Christ. This is the fix, the gospel fix for proper relationships and activities. And this can only be done when we worship and serve the Creator, who is blessed forever, to quote Paul. This leads us to number two. The dehumanizing, socially acceptable system affirms God's judgment and is actually Paul's target. The dehumanizing, socially accepted system affirms God's judgment and is Paul's target in this passage. Verse 26 and 27, for this reason God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural functions for those that are contrary to nature, and the men likewise gave up natural functions with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty of their error. Throughout this passage, he has in mind one particular biblical passage, namely Genesis 1 through 3. You might have thought that if he had been going to describe the ways in which humans had gone against God's intention, he would have done better at, say, using the background of the Ten Commandments. No, we are back at the beginning. That's where we went wrong. That's what is restored. That, so we will have a proper relationships and know that all have intrinsic dignity. Why too many of us read these sets of verses and judge those homosexuals? How awful. Those homosexuals, how awful. See, God wants to judge them. Here's the problem. Somehow this indictment against improper use of bodies is an indictment against all humankind, which includes you and me. Paul is most definitely using one particular sin. Chapter 2 and chapter 3 will remind us, however, all have sinned. One particular sin to speak to the whole of mankind's dilemma before God. We have all exchanged the glory of God for the image of corruptible men, man and animals. I believe this sin, improper sexual acts, is chosen because, and I most certainly have, I believe, the text and the historical venue on this one, because this act highlights the worst of humankind's behavior and attitude toward other human beings. Be very careful. Listen to me. Don't start judging. This is not what you think. We might like to say, I'd never do that. See, that's what's happening to many who listen. Or I am not that kind of person when we read this text. Paul will have something to say about that in chapter 2, by the way. The heart of the matter, however, is this. This is the most savage indictment on polytheism. This text isn't just about homosexuality. This text is about the degrading of another human being and the approved cultural and social system that keeps that shame in place. We must understand here, the person Paul condemns or manifests are not homosexuals, but heterosexual men taking advantage of women and children and young men. Paul is not discussing them, homosexuals, as much as he is talking about homosexual acts that degrade another person. Let's paint a picture here. This is where you need to pay attention. A horrible picture of the time of Paul while he is living in the Roman Empire. On the streets and in the temples, there are female prostitutes and hanging out in windows and doorways and brothels where they sell both for pleasure and for religious encounters. But not just women, young males, even children. At any slave auction, Paul would have found himself watching. There might be an attractive young man his own age where local pimps market them, and once sold to households as slaves, some to be sexually abused and to temples to be pimped out for religion. There was no coming back once this was done to them. This was the end of their life. They would be marked forever, worthless, dirty, never under the protection later when they are done with them of a household or a temple, left for mockery, loneliness, and street death. These young women and young men and pubescent children would be brought to the after-supper symposiums of wealthy, elite men for entertainment, which would have included sex. A Roman poet used the phrase, quote, to be cut to pieces, end quote, to be cut to pieces, to refer to the males in the passive role of a heterosexual relationship. Of the passive males, read forced role in a heterosexual relationship in Paul's day. The Greeks and the Romans thought that the active partner and the homosexual intercourse used humiliated and physically and morally damaged the passive one. The men's wives were basically for birthing legitimate freeborn males who could be citizens of Rome with rights and privileges. That's really what many of these wives were just for. None of them, none of the sexual playthings, whether they be women, young men, or children, would ever have face before the courts. No legal standing, never, none. Perhaps there would be some virtue in some restraint to avoid conflict with one's personal household or family. The head of household, male, would be maybe restrained somewhat between his wife, his girlfriends, female slaves, prostitutes, and non-free males. Society structures, cultural virtues, pressured men into sexual brutality toward other males. Because of the honor system, the place of privilege was affirmed by one's ability to engage and afford such extracurricular sexual prowess. The system locked people into the only way of social interacting. The Greeks and Romans even held homosexual rape to be divinely sanctioned. This is how twisted and doubled back the ethics of homosexuality, if you will, the acts, were among the Greeks and the Romans. It is nothing like today, but we have its equivalent, listen, in forms of racism, sex trafficking, pedophilia, and new and old zoning laws, etc., 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 and you get the point. Perhaps this is why we desire, if you will, that it seems easy to attach the biblical view of marriage and homosexuality to this text, precisely because it speaks to our deepest, darkest side of our relationships with other human beings, all because of some form of honoring privilege we so desire. The word used for male has two basic ideas here. One would have been in the Roman Gentile world, the Greek world, the male who has dominance, if you will, in the arena of sex. This is not the normal, typical use of the word man for Paul, anthropos. This is an error. But also for the Jew, the Jewish believer would have picked up on this. This is not that normal word for man, but for male, and Jews would have easily understood this as the person referred to in the creation account. There is man, there is male, and there is female. There is male, and there is female. He's going back to the creation account, where this is the design that God has, not just for marriage, but for all social relationships. This isn't what we were made for. This dark honor system doesn't bring God glory or put us before Him with grateful hearts. The Greeks and the Romans didn't have a thoroughly just God in their pantheon of gods to correct the imbalances in the universe. Usually, of course, there was the head gods, Zeus, from the Greeks, and from the Romans, the Jupiter. But they had vested interests. They weren't there for true justice and a good social, cultural interactions among people. They were interested in free-born male citizens being affirmed in the culture. Thus, this skewed, if you will, justice in favor of the free-born male. There is no doubt that Paul is taking a swipe at the power structure of his day, at the honor system of his day. Again, his point is to the house churches in Rome. This is not what males and females were made for. Don't read just marriage here. This is not what males and females were made for. This is partly a setup too, because the Jews would have found the issue of sexual and this type of morality or immorality would be traced to idolatry. This would have been anathema to many of them. But it's not simple idolatry. It is the exchanging of authorities in the system of idolatry, which in Rome is the honor system, which was still true among Jewish homes. And a spoiler alert here. He's ready. Paul's ready for them in chapters 2 and 3 because he knows they're going to say, the Jews will say, yeah, I'm not like that. That's awful. That's terrible. I'm not that bad. And Paul's going to write, oh, yes, you are. This leads us to our third point. The list of negative virtues is at the heart of an evil honor system. Verses 28 through 32. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, this is kind of going back to step one, God gave them up to a debased mind to what they ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. They, though they know God's righteous decree, that those who practice them such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. People who have refused to acknowledge God, that is, honor God and give Him thanks, end up with minds that are disqualified from being able to understand and acknowledge the will of God, i.e. to know and do God's design and purpose for them. The result, of course, is that they do things that are not proper. It will only be the renewing of the mind that can come and overcome this deep-seated blindness and perversity in Romans 12, 1 and 2. Remember, this is a history sweep over all time. So as a result, God handing them over to a debased mind here. Here is the longest New Testament list of antisocial, non-Christian, pagan, polytheistic virtues. Note, every one of them is social. Connects negatively in relations to others. Also note that there is not one mention here of sexual acts or sexual perversity. This list is about how we treat one another, which is the underlying reason for such a perverse and vile system of honor and shame which Paul has been targeting. There are almost no need to explain, just to read and to leave them hanging there, and that's what I'm going to do for the most part. They were filled with all manner of injustice, unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, strife, murder, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. This list of ungodly virtues undergird, if you will, and are the way in which people, especially men in Paul's day, particularly the elite, free-born Roman citizen, the top of the privileged of Paul's day, the way in which they live so they can out to others in the matter of honor. It is why people are invited to that supper, banquet, and symposium. It is why people are seated at the table the way they are. It is why people are even at the table. It is why certain entertainment is brought in. This vile list is the how and the why people are A-listed, honored. This is the way people live so that they are more honored than someone else. This is the vile list in how people get ahead, get the right recognition, the right seats in public, the right applause. Verses 29 to 31, this is the purpose of this list, which is the longest of its kind in the New Testament, is to show the general scope of social evils produced by unqualified minds to which God has handed over to judgment and letting the course of history just go. The sin of human self-exaltation before God and other people is conveyed in the next three words, those three words, proud, arrogant, overbearing. Proud, arrogant, overbearing. The reference to disobedient to parents probably means the newer generation is arrogant towards the older generation. They know better. Nothing has changed there, right? This list works because we are sinful at our core. And this is how we work it to make sure we are at the top of the honor list. Invited to all the right parties, to be acknowledged by the right people, pointed out by the right person. Let's put this in perspective using the sinful acts and the intention behind them that Paul indicts at the beginning of our text. Let's put this in perspective. This update. When we gossip, when we are envious, I'm going to change this. When I gossip, when I am envious, when I use malice to look better than someone else, when I slander to prop myself and downgrade someone else, when I am envious of others, when I am deceitful to knock down to size, when I am insolent, arrogant, when I invent evil to keep back someone or to get back at someone and to ensure that I am seen on top, I am foolish, disloyal, heartless, ruthless, and no better than a heterosexual male who degrades, uses, abuses women, young men, children for selfish sexual pleasure and to boost one's status. I am no different. We abide the same system. Verse 32, the function of this concluding verse is to bring out even more fully the willful rebellion against God that pervades humanity. It just keeps on going. This text isn't about your peeps propping you up and cheering you on because you have out-gossiped, out-envied, out-deceived the other person. This text isn't about cheering on political progressive liberalism. This text isn't about accepting the cultural slide into vile humanism. This text isn't about us all breathing. This text is about us all breathing in the same cultural garbage, about all of us having unqualified minds to change the system of human tiered hierarchy. Whether it's on the big scale of people groups in cultural privilege or within our gang or circle of friends. Approval basically means the acceptance of the conditions and the system that enforce and reveal, if you will, our ultimate sin of exchanging God's glory for the image of lesser things and of animals. Someone wrote, "We are not only bent and damaged ourselves, but we congratulate others in doing of those things that we know have the same issue in damnation. Still, without grace, we are unable to respond properly to whatever knowledge of God is that we possess." Okay, where do we go from here? What do we do with this? There is no doubt Paul is reaching back to creation to remind us of our purpose as his image bearers. However, Paul's intention is to get at the house churches in Rome, which means us, our local churches, to believe and grasp and live out the gospel, because it is the only place to solve our sin problem and ameliorate the system that continues to degrade and dehumanize and honor some and shame others. As the pair in the Garden of Eden were designed for marriage, they were commanded to be fruitful and multiply, more image bearers, so God would be more glorified. Now the church is God's design for humanity, and we need to act like it. Every time a local church gathers, it should be a protest against all ungodliness and injustice. I am talking about the actual gathering should be the protest. This is why Paul was so eager to preach the gospel concerning King Jesus, the Messiah, to the house churches in Rome. Paul wanted them to be a real protest. So he had to give them a lesson in God's gospel to fix the two congregational problem in Rome, where the class and social divisions between Greeks, barbarians, the educated, the uneducated, Gentiles and Jews had created an unwelcome in each of their house churches. Can't be true outpost of gathered protest without getting the gospel and its social implications right. That's why Paul is eager to preach, not to the unchurched alone here, but to the house churches in Rome. This text should send shivers down our spines. We should feel somewhat responsible and condemned too. This text should have us so desiring a remedy for this vile condition. This text makes us run to the cross, not just to find our own forgiveness, which we should, and it does, but also to ask God to make our church the image bearer for all to see God's glory and for us to render him thanksgiving. I believe this text is going to be the text that points to the church as the place where the solution is found.